organization is Health Status and Service Use Among Young Injection Drug Users, and I would just like to thank and acknowledge my colleagues, Dr. Stephen Lankenau, Dr. Bill Sanders, and the epidemiologist on the study, Jennifer Jackson Bloom, and also to acknowledge that the research is supported by a NIDA grant. Okay, I have three objectives for this presentation. Number one is to identify health problems reported by homeless young IDU. We had a small sample, and I would like to note that specifically this was a sample of young ketamine injectors, which I'll describe in more detail. Number two, to describe the types of health services utilized by this sample in the previous 12 months. And to explore, number three, to explore barriers that exist to introducing preventive health care to an otherwise hidden or very unique population of young people. First of all, why were we looking at ketamine? Ketamine is a surgical anesthetic with dissociative and hallucinogenic properties. It was developed in the United States in 1962. During the 1980s and 90s, recreational use began among club-going youth in the U.S. and the United Kingdom. And by the late 1990s, epidemiological surveillance reports indicated that youth were injecting ketamine. However, no descriptive data existed on risks, such as overdose, dependence, HCV and HIV risks, or on the population of users in general. So in 2002, research began on young ketamine injectors in three cities, New York, New Orleans, and the population we're going to focus on here, which is Los Angeles. The Los Angeles study was composed of two phases. First was a cross-sectional study. The enrollment criteria just involved being between 16 and 28 years old and having injected ketamine in the last 2 years. Ethnographers targeted neighborhoods populated with young people or known for drug selling, including Hollywood, Santa Monica, and Venice Beach. Should be noted, ethnographers also checked club sites in Los Angeles as well, and although they did find ketamine use, there was no ketamine injection, therefore our recruitment was street-based. A semi-structured in-depth interview was administered on laptops and digitally recorded. The interviews focused on drug injection events, drug use histories, risk behaviors, and demographics. In total, we recruited 101 young IDUs during the cross-sectional phase that were eligible for enrollment in a longitudinal study. So phase two of the study was longitudinal. Enrolled subjects consented to a maximum of five follow-up interviews occurring every 3 to 4 months. We collected locator information, or whatever was available. It was very minimal. Often included the odd telephone number or more frequently email addresses. Ethnographers also had toll-free numbers connected to their cell phones, so respondents could call at their leisure to check in for free from payphones wherever they were. Some of the follow-up interviews, therefore, were conducted over the telephone, and we paid our respondents via Western Union, and that became very handy, as you will see in a moment. Follow-up interviews focused on a range of issues, including recent drug use, high-risk events, access to health care, and health status. And of the 101 eligible respondents, 64 completed questions pertaining to health, which is kind of remarkable considering that they really spread out all over the place, which I'll talk about in just a moment. This is who our sample was. They were largely male, or at least slightly more male than female, largely white and in their early 20s. And I think that this is key because they were no longer minors. They were no longer able to access maybe a lot of services that were available to them when they were under 18. Furthermore, sexual identity, largely heterosexual. Those who did identify as bisexual were almost exclusively women. Majority had completed high school or the equivalent in education. This group had extensive history with the criminal justice system. Almost all of them had a history of arrest. Many had spent, you know, at least some jail time, and the prison, there were a number to have already served time in prison, and at that age, it's pretty impressive. There are high rates of experience with drug treatment and mental health care, which is kind of interesting because you think, well, they're not accessing that many services. How come they have so much history in drug treatment and mental health care? I think it's key to note that drug treatment was, there's a high rate of recidivism with drug treatment, and much of that was linked to the criminal justice system. And mental health care was often occurred as minors, and I think that that's key with this population as well. There was a high rate of testing for HIV and Hep C, and although no one self-reported HIV, being HIV positive, over a quarter of the population did report receiving a positive Hep C test. And again, we did not do testing as a part of this study. We were relying on self-report. The entire sample reported some history of homelessness, and almost all of them were homeless at the time of interview. Interestingly, 70% identified as being a traveler youth, and I'm going to go into a little bit more detail about that. Traveling youth are youth who frequently move from city to city. They use a wide range of transportation, and their patterns are highly varied. They travel around on freight trains, hitchhiking, using friends' cars, even bicycles and buses. The travel patterns are influenced by seasonal variation, music festivals, where they can get better drugs, work opportunities, or just avoiding law enforcement. And this lifestyle results in infrequent or ineffective healthcare utilization. Specifically, a lack of knowledge of area services when they move from one city to the next, piecing together where the needle exchange is, where to access certain services is definitely something that takes time. Furthermore, avoiding prosecution means that they frequently have to move on to another city within a certain amount of time just to avoid any kind of prosecution or warrants being called in. And furthermore, age. The sample relates to adolescents more than they do older homeless populations, yet often they are above the age of youth drop-in centers and may not be permitted to utilize their services. There's a widespread aversion to using homeless shelters, and they don't like them, they don't use them. So, and there's a general distrust, I think, of government agencies. Just to give you an idea of how highly mobile this population was, this is a picture of where respondents traveled to for follow-up interviews. So keeping in mind that all of these individuals were originally recruited in Los Angeles between 2005 and 2006, when they called us for follow-ups, these are some of the locations that they had traveled to. There's pretty even dispersal across the United States. Of course, there's heavier concentration in metropolitan areas, but there was a surprising stop here and there throughout more rural areas of the United States as well. This also gives you an idea of the challenge to following up with this population. We were just doing interviews. We weren't administering care, which would have, of course, been impossible. Okay, so this sample had an extensive injection history. Of course, 100% had injected ketamine, and that was an eligibility criteria for the study. But 64% of these individuals preferred injection as their mode of administration compared to sniffing, smoking, or ingesting. They had injected a range of substances, the big three, heroin, methamphetamine, and powder cocaine, as well as more adventurous experimental injections with various substances, including LSD, PCP, and even one respondent who reported injecting mushroom tea with definitely unsuccessful results. That was not a good story. Also, polydrug use and multi-drug use were very commonly reported by this population. And this is just a glimpse of what the sample reported using in the past 30 days. So what this essentially represents is a group who's very, very open-minded to drug use and trying various things, which, of course, I'm sure would have implications for drug treatment programs. You can just pick one and they might switch to another. There's definitely a cafeteria style of drug using. What's interesting is despite the high incidence of drug use and high rates of homelessness, most self-reported their health to be good or better. They really thought that they were doing just fine. However, upon more closer questioning about this, most reported current or recent health problems within the last 12 months. Most reported dental problems, which often involved very severe decay and often associated with a lot of pain. Furthermore, mental health problems were very frequently reported, which is kind of interesting because we were relying on self-report of problems, and this again reflects that these young people had experience with mental health care in the past, had largely been diagnosed or in care for mental health problems, and at this stage were largely going untreated. And so they were aware of problems and were in fact experiencing problems and were not receiving mental health care when we spoke with them. Also, vision problems, non-injection related skin infections, including staph, MRSA, and parasites, hearing problems, abscess, and sexually transmitted infections. However, they had limited contact with health services, and the medical care was limited to the following. 50% had access to free clinic in the last 12 months, which is actually quite good. Almost 50% had seen a health professional in jail. However, this number also includes intake physicals, where they might have been in front of a health provider, been given a once-over, but not necessarily received any care. But about 40% had also visited an ER for emergency treatment. Less than 20% had actually seen a private physician in the past year. Now, there are two instances, actually, two other major health issues that emerged during follow-up that deserve special attention and require specific interventions. Those include overdose and reproductive health issues. Regarding overdose, 63% reported at least one lifetime overdose. And again, we were flexible with this definition, but we let them sort of define their own overdose. 30% reported over three lifetime overdoses, and nearly a quarter had overdosed in the last 12 months. A majority of them had known over one or more persons who died from an overdose, so they were very aware of the risk that they were facing with injection drug use. And sharing was a huge issue. 68% had shared at least one syringe in the last 12 months, with an average number of sharing events being 13 in the past year. It should be noted that many of those sharing events were done with a monogamous sex partner, but also kind of makes you think about HCV risk of transmission. They were sharing needles with their sex partners. Also, sexual health and pregnancy among women. 67% of the women reported a history of pregnancy. And almost one half of the most recent pregnancies that we asked about resulted in births, which is, you know, interesting. They were homeless, and in some cases, pregnancy was a reason to get housed and a reason to get care. And in fact, 72% reported receiving prenatal care at some point during the most recent pregnancy. So again, pregnancy presents a unique, situation where they may be a little more open to care. Just to put it in context here, the barriers that we're dealing with getting care to this population. This 22-year-old man got shot in the leg and didn't want to go to the hospital because of outstanding warrants. He finally did go, and they did exactly what he expected, and they called the cops, so he left. He then traveled to New York, where his leg got extremely infected, and he had to go to a clinic. He was able to finally get antibiotics until he went to jail, and then they took them away from him. And fortunately, healed up anyway. Another 24-year-old woman was covered by her mother's HMO. When she was covered, she would go to the hospital for free. Otherwise, she doesn't go. Now, if there's an emergency situation, she just lies to them, gives them a fake name and address if she needs medical attention she cannot afford. And I think this is a very real concern for this population. We did have some who suffered very severe accidents, and one received a hospital bill of $300,000 for an overdose in which he received third-degree burns. He fell out on a steam grate, and, you know, I do think that these situations follow these young people. Also, the consequences of minimal preventive care. This respondent just talks about, staph infections being so prevalent out on the street. She had an abscess. The abscess got infected, and then it spread. She was finally able to get it to go away because she went to her mom's house and kept herself clean. Another 24-year-old woman went to the dentist 4 years ago and had over 20 cavities at that time. They had time to fill one, but that was 4 years ago, and she's very concerned that the problem has progressed. So the conclusion, young homeless IDs experience a range of long-term and acute health problems associated with their high-risk lifestyle. Their contact with healthcare providers is really limited, though, and it's limited to free services or emergency services. And more serious health concerns such as drug overdose or pregnancy may require specific interventions which may or may not be available wherever they're traveling to at the time. The high mobility of the population makes treatment of chronic health problems difficult, particularly mental health and Hep C, or any treatment that requires repeated visits over time because of their transience. And also, just the age that they are, again, this group, it relates more to adolescence, and I think this extended adolescent phase really slips through the cracks of our current system in that they're not accessing things available to older, homeless, or injection drug-using populations and maybe shut out of some of the services that are available to younger populations. And for future research questions, we certainly would like to look at what health problems are related to youth's high-risk lifestyles and might be avoided with preventive health measures. And that's just to contrast that with maybe what health problems are rather ordinary to 20, 22-year-olds, but have just been exacerbated maybe by, you know, just, for example, tooth decay. It's not a necessarily an IDU problem, but due to the lifestyle and lack of hygiene, is much worse in this population. And then also, of course, are there lasting physical and psychological effects of a high-risk lifestyle that will impact these individuals later in life? Basically, we don't know what happens to this population. They're young, and there's a bit of bravado to this group in that they might be able to stop what they're doing whenever they want to, and we don't know if, in fact, that's true. So we don't know if they decide to get housed and make changes in their life, and if they decide to return to, a more normal existence, what will be with them from their rough years on the street. And this is just a view from our office. The street is a little seedier, but we... And thank you very much.